Penguin Random House Audio presents The Personal Librarian by Marie Benedict and Victoria Christopher Murray. Read for you by Robin Miles. For the Two Sides of Belle, Belle da Costa Green and Belle Marion Greener. Chapter 1. November 28, 1905. Princeton, New Jersey. The old North Bell tolls the hour, and I realize that I'll be late. I long to break into a sprint, my voluminous skirts lifted, my legs flying along the Princeton University pathways. But just as I gather the heavy material, I hear Mama's voice. "Bell, be a lady at all times." I sigh. A lady would never run. I release the fabric and slow down as I weave through Princeton's leafy Gothic landscape, designed to look like Cambridge and Oxford. I know I must do nothing to draw any kind of extra attention. By the time I pass Blair Arch, my stride is quick but acceptable for a lady. It's been 5 years since I left our New York City apartment for this sleepy New Jersey college town, and the quiet is still unnerving. On the weekends, I wish I could return to the energy of New York, but the 60 cents for a train ticket is outside our family's budget. So I send money home instead. As I duck under a crenellated tower, I moderate my pace so I won't be breathless when I arrive. "You are at Princeton University. You must take extra care working at that all-male institution. Be cautious. Never do anything to stand out." Even though she's nearly 60 miles away, Mama insinuates herself into my thoughts. Pushing the heavy oak door slowly to minimize its loud creak, I pad as quietly as my calfskin boots allow across the marble foyer before I sidle into the office I share with two other librarians. The room is empty, and I exhale in relief. If sweet-natured Miss McKenna saw me arrive late, it would be of no import. But with hood-eyed, nosy Miss Adams, I could never be certain she wouldn't mention my offense at some future time to our superior. I remove my coat and hat, careful to smooth my rebellious, curly hair back into place. Tucking my somber navy skirt beneath me, I slide onto my chair. Within minutes, the office door flies open, slamming against the wood-paneled wall, and I jump. It is my only dear friend, fellow librarian, and housemate, Gertrude Hyde. As the niece of the esteemed head of purchasing for the library, Charlotte Martins, she can breach the quiet of the library's hallowed halls without fear of repercussions. An ebullient 23-year-old with ginger hair and bright eyes. No one makes me laugh as she does.
"Sorry to make you jump, dear Belle. I guess I owe you two apologies now, instead of the single one I'd intended. First, we abandoned you this morning, which undoubtedly led to your lateness," she says with a mischievous smile and a glance at the wall clock. "And now, I've given you a fright. Don't be silly. The fault is mine. I should have put aside that letter to my mother and walked to campus with you and Charlotte. Miss Martins, I mean," I correct myself. Most days, Charlotte, Gertrude, and I walk together from their large family home on University Drive, where I have a room and share meals with Charlotte, Gertrude, and the rest of their family, who live in the house as well. From the first, Charlotte and Gertrude have welcomed me into their home and social circles with warmth and generosity, and have provided me with abundant guidance at work. I cannot imagine what my time in Princeton would have been like without them.
"Belle, why are you fussing about what to call Aunt Charlotte? There's nobody in here but you and me." Gertrude mock scolds me.
I don't say what I'm thinking.
That Gertrude doesn't need to assess every single moment of every single day against societal standards to ensure her behavior passes muster. She has no need to analyze her words, her walk, her manner. But I do. Even with Gertrude, I must act with care, particularly given the heightened scrutiny in this university town, which operates as if it lies in the segregated South rather than in the supposedly more progressive North. The distinctive clip of Miss Adams's shoes sounds in the hallway outside my office door, and Gertrude's skirt rustles as she moves to leave. She has as much fondness for my office mate as I do, and she'll skedaddle before she can get locked into a conversation. Before she exits the office altogether, she turns back to me, whispering, "Are you still free for the philosophy lecture tonight?" Since Woodrow Wilson assumed the presidency of Princeton University 3 years ago and instituted all sorts of scholastic reform, the number of lectures open to staff and members of the community has increased. While Gertrude and I revel in being included in the academic life of the campus, I loathe certain of Wilson's other decisions, such as maintaining Princeton as a whites-only university when all the other Ivy League schools have admitted colored folks. But I would never voice aloud these views. Instead, I say, "Wouldn't miss it for the world." The quiet of the stacks wraps around me like a soft blanket. I relax into the subdued hush of patrons turning pages and the scent of leather bindings. My long days spent in the company of medieval manuscripts and early printed books calm and delight me. Imagining the labors of the first printing press users as they memorialized the English language and broadly disseminated its literature through the meticulous work of placing the type letter by letter, transforming empty pages into beautiful text to inspire worshippers and readers, transports me beyond the limitations of this time and place, just as Papa always believed. To him, the written word could act as an invitation to free thought and the broader world, and nowhere was that more true than in the dawn of the printed word, where, for the first time, that invitation could be made to the masses instead of a select few. "Miss Green!" I hear a soft voice from beyond the stacks. Two simple words, but my visitor's modulated tone and distinctive accent give him away. And anyway, I've been waiting for him. "Good day, Mr. Morgan," I reply, turning in his direction. Even though I'm talking softly, Miss Scott glances up from the circulation desk with a disapproving scowl. It isn't so much the volume of my speech as the pleasantness of my relationship with the fellow librarian and collection benefactor that vexes her. While Mr. Junius Morgan is ostensibly a banker, he has generously donated dozens of ancient and medieval manuscripts to the university, which is why he also holds the titular position of associate head librarian. I'm convinced that Miss Scott thinks any sort of relationship between us, even the cordial, professional one we share, is beneath him. A slight man, with wispy brown hair and a kindly expression behind his circular glasses, materializes.
"How are you today, Miss Green?"
"Well, sir. And yourself?" My tone is professional and reserved. He's 20 minutes later than the time we'd mentioned, and I'd begun to think he'd forgotten about our appointment. But I would never dare mention his tardiness.
"I was going to take a gander at the Virgils, as we discussed yesterday. I wonder if you'd still care to accompany me, assuming your duties and your interest permit, of course."
Mr. Morgan, whom I think of as Junius in the privacy of my thoughts, knows that my zeal for the library's most valuable collection is nearly as intense as his own, and that none of my other tasks will stand in the way of the private viewing he has promised. We share a passion for the ancient Roman poet Virgil. The library houses 52 volumes of his poetry. My discussions with Junius about the dark voyages in the Aeneid and the Odyssey are some of the...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?